John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and thanks so much for listening. And we want to do a little Christmas Eve quiz for all of you out there. We were sitting around the office asking ourselves this week, who is the most powerful person in the world right now? And by power, maybe we mean who is most effectively using their position to change, to lead, or influence the global community. Yes, it's a hard one. There's not going to be a formal winner in this contest. We'd love to hear your nominees, of course, 877-8-MY-TAKE. But here are a few candidates.
I'm going to act because it's the right thing for the country. But it's going to be more sustainable and more effective if the public understands what the facts are on immigration, what we've done on unaccompanied children, and why it's necessary.
Of course, no one can deny the influence of the President of the United States. But has Obama shown that he can move the world after 6 years of not really being able to move the U.S. Congress? Maybe U.S. presidents are kind of set up to look weak by the way we run our government. So how about this woman?
I find myself caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. That, ladies and gentlemen, is not a pleasant position to be in, at least not for a German head of government. Nevertheless, that cannot in any way spoil my pleasure at being here today.
Germany's Angela Merkel is widely seen as the leader with the most clout in Europe right now and the most credibility with Russia's leader, Vladimir Putin. She certainly holds all the cards economically in Europe and in many ways around the world, but she is no Kaiser. She's steady, quiet, neither bully nor pulpit. We shall see. A solid candidate, though. Then there's this guy.
Bharat Mata Ki! Bharat Mata Ki! Bharat Mata Ki! Bahut bahut dhanyawad.
India's leader Narendra Modi probably has the most eyeballs paying close attention to him in his massive country and around the world. He's also an electrifying speaker and certainly does the bully pulpit thing as well as anyone. He qualifies. But how about this soft-spoken fellow? Does he carry a big stick?
La malattia delle chiacchiere, delle mormorazioni e dei pettegolezzi.
Pope Francis's big stick is called a crozier, the pastoral staff. And the Pope, here, admonishing his College of Cardinals against spiritual disease and the pathology of power. It's the Pope's quiet style that belies an earthquake of change that he seems to be directing among the billion Roman Catholics in the world. We talk today about Pope Francis, who this year has demonstrated his influence in Cuba, in Israel, among families around the world, and his powerful colleagues in the Holy See. We spoke with John Carr, the director of the Initiative on Catholic Social Thought and Public Life at Georgetown University.
Well, this is an upside-down papacy. He looks at the world from the bottom up, and he looks at the church from the outside in. At the Christmas party for the Curia, he took the occasion to remind them that authority is service. And then he went and had a Christmas party for the janitors and the gardeners at the Vatican. He looks at the world from the bottom up because that's what Jesus talked about.
Does he describe literally the church hierarchy and bureaucracy as a form of spiritual Alzheimer's?
Well, I'm a former church bureaucrat and a new academic, so I'm a little bit defensive. I think what he's doing is reminding the members of the Curia why they came to this post, why they served the church. It was out of love for Jesus and love for his people, and so he takes on the arrogance, the judgmentalism, the self-righteousness of this bureaucracy and reminds them why they became a priest, why they sought to serve. And it's a wonderful message at Christmas.
In geopolitics, did the initiative on Cuba surprise anyone? It's very John Paul II, Cold Warrior, trying to, confront the divisions of the Cold War. But I'm wondering if he's projected a different kind of style than John Paul II.
Well, ironically, it was John Paul II who went to Cuba and called for an end to the isolation of the island, even while he stood up for human rights and religious liberty. So I think what is different is not the policy, But this is a Latin American pope, and so he brings a new urgency and a new passion to ending the isolation of the Cuban people. This is a pope in the church and in the world who believes in dialogue over isolation, and that's reflected in how he treats people within the church and how he uses the Vatican's diplomatic apparatus to try and advance dialogue. And it was not typical of the Vatican to be this public, but it was predictable that he would work to end the isolation of Cuba because, in his judgment, it hurts the Cuban people, not those who are violating human rights and religious liberty. In fact, it provides an excuse for them.
As much as he says and speaks against the entrenched power of the traditional Vatican, and as much you say he's a pope who looks from the bottom up, is he unwittingly or maybe by design increasing the profile and power of the Catholic Church in world affairs?
Well, it is a paradox that the more you assert authority, sometimes the less you have. And by focusing on what the church needs to do to serve the least of these, to be welcoming, to show mercy, he may in fact be demonstrating the church at its best. At one of our forums, Michael Gerson said, "I'm not a Catholic, but I think your pope is a troublemaker. And there's nothing more dangerous than a troublemaker with a plan." And I think the pope is something of a troublemaker. He's upsetting the status quo. But his plan is to go back to Jesus and his priorities, his values, and the way he treated people. So I think by diminishing the assertion of authority, he may in fact gain more authority.
On the troublemaker question, certainly in social issues dealing with the family and his public marrying of people who would not have been considered remarriable or marriable at all in the traditional approach of Catholicism, he's also signaled that he definitely wants reform. Does that make him more powerful or put him into a fringe group within the church?
Well, it's hard to think of the pope as a fringe, although there might be a few that would like to put him there. There are two kinds of leadership, I think. One, if you think the culture has overwhelmed the church, then you hunker down and you try and preserve and protect what you have, and you throw thunderbolts at people and leaders. The other kind of leadership reflects whether you think we can persuade people. And so then you engage and you persuade. I think Pope Francis thinks there's no one in the world that he can't reach and share the good news of our faith. Frankly, the church sometimes comes across as with the attitude of the answer is no, what is the question? And I think what Pope Francis is doing is let's talk about the question before we get to the answers. And so he will come to the United States this coming year to talk about the family. I suspect he'll come to Washington to talk about justice, and it's likely he will go to New York to talk about peace. And that's really a good summary of Pope Francis' leadership. He's trying to support families, especially those in trouble, and he's working for a world of more justice and peace, which at this Christmas season actually reflects the message pretty well.
John Carr, Director of the Initiative on Catholic Social Thought and Public Life at Georgetown University. Thanks again.
Thank you.
One of the things we've really learned this year is how cancer can clarify and simplify a lot of things in life.
Before I was diagnosed, it was hard for me to be happy. You know, I also was a perfectionist. Like, I like things to be perfect.
28-year-old Crystal Miller is delivering a message for us on this Christmas Eve. To get to perfect, she's learned you have to let go and understand that you can't control everything in life.
I like things to go the way that they were supposed to go or planned. I feel like this circumstance has changed me. It changed me for the better. You know, it allowed me to look at myself and see how I was living and turn some things around, you know, and I'm grateful that I had the chance to do that.
It is us here at The Takeaway who are grateful. And to so many of you who have supported Crystal and her breast cancer survivor soulmate, Anita Coleman, who has faced cancer twice and had numerous surgeries.
After the reconstruction, I had to conquer the look. And when I say conquer the look, I look fine on the outside to the human eye. But I know what I saw in the mirror. I saw a lot of scars. Needless to say, my bikini cut has a couple frowns. But I'm okay with that because I had to learn I am still here. I am not my body. I am my spiritual being.
Anita, Crystal, and Lisa Eccles allowed us to follow them on their journey for much of this year in interviews and in keeping audio diaries for us. Here's Lisa.
Sometimes you have to look back at things that happen in your life in order to continue to live forward. My mother did not get a chance to see me at the age of 25. And I see my daughter here at the age of 25. It just feels so good to me to be here.
Lisa, Anita, and Crystal are the leaders of our Under Her Skin community of survivors. Under Her Skin is a series of interviews, an audio diary project, and a social media experiment on The Takeaway that comes to a close today. And as we say goodbye to these women, we want to remind you how they have given face to an alarming statistic that African-American women diagnosed with breast cancer are roughly 40% more likely to die than their white counterparts.
It feels great to get the word out there and let people know, let the women of color know that you're not alone in what you're going through, because we went through the same thing. So it's good to be able to mentor and minister to women of color.
Yeah, and I would say just not a woman of color, but anybody that's going through it. I think the best times that like made me smile was like when somebody got on the Facebook group and they were newly diagnosed and they were like, you know, this just happened and I'm reaching out to you or whoever because they needed comfort. Because I think I felt the same way when I was diagnosed. I didn't know anybody that was diagnosed with breast cancer personally. So that was like, you know, that's what I yearned for. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful that we were able to provide that for somebody else.
That's great. And Anita?
Any opportunity to give positive thinking and motivation to anyone at any time, to me, is a blessing. Mm-hmm. And what you guys, John, with your radio station has done was allow for people to have an avenue. Sometimes if you just hear someone going through what you're going through, and to know that they can do it, it encourages other people to know that I too can get through this.
Yeah, so true.
Of course, you can't really say goodbye to new friends like these. Over the course of 6 months, Lisa gave us all advice on life lessons she's learned from working in an intensive care unit for newborns in Memphis. Anita visited New York this summer from L.A. and took the town by storm. And Crystal came out of her shell and became something of a media personality online and in her own community. So 6 months later, where do they stand? All three have finished their treatments, but Lisa still has one more surgery ahead, a preventive hysterectomy on December 30th. Anita also decided to have preventive surgery herself. She tested positive for the BRCA gene and recently had both ovaries removed. And a year after her diagnosis, Crystal is happy to report that she's cancer-free. On the air and online, we have come to know these women, and they've come to know each other. But it was only last week that they actually spoke together. We brought them together to think about this year and so we could say goodbye. All three are busy making holiday preparations, but the news from their doctors, it turns out, is better than any Christmas present.
I mean, for me, it's, you know, I'm a couple of days away from my diagnosis from last year, so it'll be a year. So it's very, you know, it signifies a lot. And just like the new year coming up, I really didn't want to bring this into the new year. I just want to, like, make the next year the best year of my life. It's really a reflection on how far I've come and that I've made it. You know, I got through it. And I know this probably won't be the only thing in my life. Things happen. But it's going to be a reminder that I can, you know, I am a conqueror. I can get through anything.
And you got your pals.
Yes.
Yeah. That's right. Anita, how about you?
I'm looking forward to the holiday season. First of all, not to have any doctor's appointments. I have one more on Tuesday. It's a blessing. Every day is a blessing, mm-hmm, for me, because this is my second time around. Mm-hmm. So I just am thankful. I'm coming up on a year in February for my diagnosis, and I'm thankful for all the support system I have, my family, and just knowing that I am empowered to get through anything, it's just a feeling that it frees you.
You're nodding, Lisa?
I am. My year from diagnosis has passed. Mine was December the 9th. And when it came to that, you know, it was like I could exhale. And just at this point, I can enjoy life and be so grateful. You know, some people take life for granted. But when you have went through a storm, you cherish every moment, every day, every bite of food that you can eat that you couldn't probably eat when you was going through chemo, and every strength that God has given to you that you didn't have when you was going through. It's just the little bitty things to me that counts.
So anything about your stories that you didn't want to share that was really off limits to the community of Under Her Skin, Lisa?
No, I shared everything. I want people to really know, and when they hear my voice, to know what I've been through. You know, I don't want to hold anything back, because if you hold something back, then somebody might need that information. So I don't want to hold back anything, and I didn't hold anything back.
Anita?
I haven't held anything back, because what cancer did for me is it let me be a little bit freer in expression. Because Crystal and Lisa, I know you can emphasize with me, like when you go to the doctor and all these different doctors, you're open, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, oh no, don't look here, don't look there. And so what I've done is, if a lady asks me, well, how does the burns look, you know, hey, let's step over here, you can see.
Yeah.
Why hold back? Because what you can show somebody or tell somebody, it eases their pain. Because people are apprehensive. And when I was going through radiation in my last couple of days, when the burning was really bad, my doctor shielded me. She didn't want a new patient to see me. She said, because if the lady saw how much pain I was in and how I was walking, and I said, but no, let us see. I mean, you know, who in fall goes to the doctor in a tube top dress? Because I couldn't wear a bra and the pain was excruciating. But when she said, I don't want her to see what you're going through because it'll keep her from wanting to do it, I said, no, if she sees it, she can embrace it. Because fear, we're our own worst enemies. And if you're fearful of something, but you see somebody else who's gone through it, it helps you get through it.
Yeah.
Crystal, I'm sensing you maybe learned a little more about vulnerability this year.
Yeah, and, you know, I was pretty open during the whole thing. But something I probably did keep back was dating. I really didn't speak about that, but I am dating somebody. And he's been around since the beginning, but not until recently where we really started dating and stuff like that. And I think now it's important for me to share, because that was some of... maybe that, as far as vulnerability, I didn't really want to be that vulnerable, because there's room for rejection or somebody not wanting to go through this with you and stuff like that. And, you know, having to show scars and those type of things. I'm on a drug that can make you feel like you're in menopause and all those things. And, you know, I just want to share it now, because I think it's important for other women of all ages to know that this doesn't have to be something that hinders that. And there are people who will understand and are willing to, like, work through things with you. So that's something I didn't share.
So Anita and Lisa, it sounds like this guy maybe passed the test over the last
year. I think so.
Yeah, I say, go Crystal, because to me, this is my opinion. It's an honor. Whoever I end up with, it's an honor for them to be with me. Because you have to see yourself in that light. So Crystal, you are worthy. Know that whoever you pick, it's not they picked you, you picked them. And it's an honor, because to me, our wounds are like pins that, you know, I'm not saying we're soldiers in a war, but, you know, if you get a medal of valor, whatever, your scars, they're your medals. You know, it's a tribute to what you went through and how you persevered to be here. So
you know, he's blessed. He's lucky. Tell him he better tell him he doesn't want me to come from California.
Thank you.
Now we really put the pressure. What a way to end the year. Well, ladies, it's been great being with you this year, and I really admire your candor and, you know, your willingness to share and being at the center of this great community.
Yeah, I want to thank you so much for, like, providing us with the platform.
Yes.
And also bringing attention to breast cancers and minorities.
Yes.
And the disparities amongst those, you know, different groups and stuff like that. It's talked about all the time in my field, but I don't think a lot of people, even other breast cancer survivors that I share certain statistics with, you know, they're not aware of it. So I want to, you know, I'm very grateful for providing the platform for us to speak and get our stories out there.
You guys have been great.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And for our final time, we say thank you and best of luck to the three ladies we followed this year, Crystal Miller of New York, Anita Coleman in Los Angeles, and Lisa Eccles from Memphis, Tennessee. You can find the entire series on our website, thetakeaway.org. And although we wrap up this project, the Facebook group is still active, and you can join by typing in Under Her Skin. Are things starting to move at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba, along with everything else suddenly swirling about in the U.S.-Cuba relationship? There are 132 detainees today at Gitmo, the fewest prisoners since President Bush opened the facility nearly 13 years ago. Nevertheless, this week, Cliff Sloan, the State Department's envoy to Guantanamo, resigned. And while Sloan says it was simply time for him to leave, there is a lingering sense that state is not happy with the Pentagon's pace of Guantanamo prison transfers. For more on the state of Guantanamo, the detention center's possible future, we turn to Carol Rosenberg, reporter for the Miami Herald. Carol, welcome back.
Hi, John.
Has the, you know, sort of tsunami of change on the other side of Cuba had anything to do with what's going on at Gitmo right now?
Alas, I don't think there's any connection. I think what's happened in the past couple of months with this little mini surge of detainees leaving is the fruit of about a year's worth of work by this man, Cliff Sloan, who'd been out traveling the world trying to persuade countries to do the thing that Congress won't do, which is take in these men who have been cleared for release and give them a new shot at life in their countries.
And why would Sloan leave if you've had so much success?
Well, I think this job requires kind of a special kind of patriotism. First of all, you are in conflict with Congress because the path to closing Guantanamo really does require moving at least some of these men to U.S. soil. So he's out there trying to persuade our allies, you know, friendly countries, to take in the people that our own Congress won't let set foot on U.S. soil. So you go out there and you peddle packages, you take files of individuals and say, look at this poor guy. We told him in 2008 or 2009 that we had no reason to keep him. And now we just need somebody to take him in. And I think that he has done well. He's gotten about three dozen out. But maybe we're coming to the end of that, as you call it, wave of transfers. And the next thing requires a fresh start.
Is there any sense that Sloan may have set up some quid pro quos here that we will learn about once he's gone, in the sense that all these nations who have taken in detainees must have been asking Sloan, come on, guys, you're going to take some of these, right? 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 And Sloan would have to have winked and nodded on that, even though he knows Congress has said no up till now.
I think just the opposite. I think what we learned from the WikiLeaks cables is that these diplomats who are traveling the world have basically appealed to the better nature of these countries on behalf of the president. I mean, if you're looking for a quid pro quo, I have in front of me this fascinating document that President Mujica in Uruguay handed out at a press conference recently. You know, he took in six men, four Syrians, a Palestinian, and a Tunisian man, all of them cleared. And in this letter, Cliff Sloan writes that there is no information that these men were involved in conducting or facilitating terrorist activities. And I don't think that he was traveling the world saying, don't worry, the president's going to work it out with Congress. I think just the opposite. I think he was peddling packages of people who shouldn't have been there for some time. And as I said, appealing to their better nature. That is the Uruguay deal, by the way. And I, you know, don't want to focus too much on Uruguay, but that is also the new frontier, right? This is the first resettlement into South America. Jose Mujica is this Mandela-like figure.
Right.
And so if Sloan is replaced, the next person could be really traveling Latin America as he did or as his office did, looking for countries in our own hemisphere to take in people who are approved to go. You know, there's 64 people there on a list who are approved to go. The majority of them are Yemenis. And if you follow the news in Yemen, they're not going back to Yemen. So it's not fair to say the hard part starts now because it's been hard for a very long time. But finding places for Yemenis who can't go home on a case-by-case basis, fixing up arrangements for individual men to start new lives in new places, it's a very difficult job.
And it's the challenge for 2015 as the Obama administration tries to deal with the remaining detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Carol Rosenberg, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Carol Rosenberg is a reporter for the Miami Herald.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
So what about a holiday movie release guide? Is that user-friendly or what? That's how we're going to end this hour. Kristen Mines, our Enrafer Guzman, the Takeaway Movie Date co-hosts are here. Welcome, guys.
Happy holidays, John.
Merry Christmas. We've got a lot to get to here. All those movie trailers that say, released this Christmas. It's here.
They're here.
And there's a
Christmas
lot of stuff.
Day.
We can't really begin without mentioning that the interview is going to be one of them all of a sudden.
That's in right. Some theaters, yeah, absolutely.
About 300 theaters now nationwide, they're saying.
And Sony's kind of capitulated. They sort of say, all right, we will release it. You know, they're just yanked all around the universe on this whole story.
It depends on what, you know, you say capitulate. I think Sony would say that they've rallied for the cause of freedom, you know, that, you know, freedom of speech will not be suppressed. You know, this was originally going to be a wide release in, you know, a couple thousand theaters at least. Now we're talking about 300. I'll be interested to see if the curiosity factor is enough to draw people out or if the negative reviews and the negative repercussions will keep people away. Well, you will see.
We've already reviewed it. You gave it a B minus, right?
Something around that.
Do you have a grade on it?
Something like a C minus.
C minus. Okay. Let's get into the other movies that are coming out. To Into the Woods. Here's a clip.
Stay with me. Princes, wait. There in the world, it's true.
Sondheim on screen. Is this a Les Mis, kind of everybody sings through the whole movie kind of release?
It's pretty much all singing, and that's Meryl Streep as the witch, who is like the main character. She puts a curse on some other characters, and all these characters are kind of Brothers Grimm fairy tale characters. And we see all of them meet each other and help and hurt each other, including Little Red Riding Hood, the wolf, Jack and the Beanstalk. And full disclosure, I'm just not a fan of this musical. I don't really like the music in it, but all that being said, the acting's terrific. Meryl Streep's fantastic. The staging is beautiful. The sets are terrific. So I think people who like the musical are going to enjoy this.
And?
Yeah, I think Disney is pitching this as a family film for the Christmas day, for the Christmas holiday. I'm not sure it really is one. It's pretty dark. You know, this is like a psychological, moralistic view of the fairy tales. And I think my main objection is that none of these characters seem like characters. They all seem like archetypes and mythical symbols to me.
All right. The next movie, which is a big release, Selma.
We will not wait any longer. Give us the vote.
That's right. No more.
We're not asking. We're demanding. Give us the vote.
Is this an Oprah Winfrey kind of walking the corridors of history kind of production, Rafer?
You might think that because she is indeed in it, and this is about Martin Luther King, the voting rights marches of 1965.
And hugely important history.
Hugely important. And you've got David Oyelowo playing Martin Luther King. What I like about this movie, though, is it's not really a biopic. It really feels like a glimpse inside the making of a movement. You really get to see the inner workings of the movement, the things they had to deal with, the deaths, the riots, the politics. Tom Wilkinson plays President Johnson.
Wow.
I thought it was really good. To me, this is one of the best movies of the year. Mm. And Oyelowo is great.
Oh, I have to totally agree. Oyelowo is mind-blowing. You forget that this is not actually MLK alive giving these speeches. And the scenes of violence, I have to warn people, are incredibly shocking and very moving in this, but
historically accurate.
Historically accurate, yeah. And just a few months it's focusing on, and we're seeing a lot of backroom deals, a lot of dark conversations. But overall, I thought it was very good. A little bit overly long, but just a great performance by David Oyelowo.
Rafer, you are a big Tim Burton fan, yes?
I like Tim Burton, yes.
All right, big eyes.
Why are their eyes so big? Like big stale jelly beans.
It's expressionism.
It's not art.
It's not art.
It's like the back of a magazine, you know, draw the turtle, send in a nickel, win the big contest.
How dare you? Lots of people will like this.
Well, nobody who's walking through the doors of this gallery.
So, what did you think? This is a curious premise.
It is. It's the story of Margaret Keane, the woman who did the Keane paintings, the big, big, giant saucer-eyed Moppets holding kittens and crying, kitsch art from the 1960s. The little-known story is that her husband took all the credit for her work during the 60s and made all the money, and she had to stand up for herself and claim her ownership. I think it's really a lot of fun. It's great performances. Amy Adams plays Margaret Keane. Christoph Waltz plays her husband. Mm. He's great. That was Jason Schwartzman as the gallery owner. He's hilarious in this movie. I think this has the possibility of becoming a real hit, maybe even becoming this year's King's Speech. Whether it goes to the Oscars, I don't know, but it feels like a real crowd pleaser to me.
An unusual offering for Tim Burton, whose life is changing, Helena Bonham Carter, and he are breaking up.
Yes, indeed. You know, what I like about this is it's less of the crazy, wacky, goth Tim Burton. It's very straightforward and light, and it has a heart, and it feels really fun, and you love these characters.
All right. Does Brad Cooper kill it?
Tell me why you do it.
Come on.
I want to understand.
Babe, I do it for you. You know that I do to protect you.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
I'm here. Your family is here. Your children have no father.
Well, you'll have to serve my country.
You don't know when to quit.
Brad Cooper as American Sniper.
Yeah.
What did you think?
A real sniper, Chris Kyle. It's based on his real experience doing 4 tours of duty and what effect that had on his family. And unfortunately, I felt the movie, because we're following him in these 4 tours of duty, it starts to feel very repetitive, and it's hard to distinguish one tour from the next after a while. And so I found it very exhausting to watch this movie, and I didn't see a lot change in the plot or the characters that went along. And I needed more from this movie.
Cooper's performance?
Cooper is absolutely astounding to me in this performance. He really feels like one of these kind of rugged, stressed out war veterans. You don't see the pretty boy Cooper from The Hangover in this. It's a great performance, great direction from Clint Eastwood. I feel like this movie basically says, this is the way it was. It was rough. Take it or leave it.
All right. Our last offering, everybody's anticipating the blockbuster book, Unbroken.
I'm going to kill him.
Then they shoot you.
I don't give a damn. Let him shoot me.
That's not how we beat him. We beat him by making it to the end of the war alive. That's how we do it. That's our revenge.
Angelina Jolie, the director here. Does this work, Kristen?
Now, this is based on the real story of Louis Zamperini, who was a POW during World War II. Unfortunately, I felt that this didn't work. It's very beautiful to look at, but it really just felt like torture porn the whole time. There's not a lot of dialogue. I don't feel like a lot happens. We just see 4 different sequences, very long ones, of him being tortured.
It's a pretty compelling story. I don't feel like Jack O'Connell, the main actor, is that great, but I will say it's worth seeing for a Japanese rock star named Miyavi, who plays the camp commandant. It's an amazing, amazing performance, worth the price of admission.
So slow like Seabiscuit, the movie from Hillenbrand's other book.
Right.
But definitely there are great things in there, as there were in Seabiscuit. Rafer and Kristen, On the podcast, anything to say?
We're also going to be reviewing, in addition to all these movies, The Gambler, 2 Days, One Night, and looking at the 50th anniversary of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer this year.
Merry Christmas, guys.
Thank you so much, John.
Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, Movie Date Podcast. And that's our show for today. With Christmas upon us, we're hearing about your traditions.
My name is Jen in San Antonio, and Christmas for me is not religious. My husband and I are actually both atheists. It's more family tradition and creating memories for my daughter to give to her children as well.
We love your stories. Bring us into your home. Tell us your traditions. We'll eat the cookies. You don't have to leave them for Santa. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Have a very Merry Christmas. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.